John Lear, welcome to the Hour of the Time.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to be here.
As you can hear, my voice is not too good, so I'm going to keep my participation in this interview to a minimum. And I'd like to start out, John, with give us some background. Tell us who you are and where you came from and what you've been doing all your life up to this point in as short a period of time as you can.
Well, Bill, I'm an airline captain. I'm 50 years old, the big 5-0. I've flown about 160 different types of aircraft in over 50 different countries. I'm presently chief pilot for a cargo airline here in Nevada. We fly worldwide. I held 18 world speed records in the Learjet, including round the world speed record in 1966. And I'm the only pilot to have ever earned and held every airman certificate issued by the FAA. And among these certificates are the airline transport rating, flight instructor, ground instructor, navigator, flight engineer, dispatcher, mechanic, control tower operator, parachute rigger. And I hold the PATCO award, that's the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association award, for outstanding airmanship presented in 1968. As you know, I flew missions worldwide for the CIA and other government agencies. I've flown in Southeast Asia. I flew there between 1966 and 1973. And I've had a lot of experience in flying in Europe, the Middle East, Afghanistan, the Far East, Africa, and both Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. I flew experimental test flights for the Learjet Corporation and other companies, but I really liked airline flying. And as an airline pilot, I was what they call a non-scheduler, which means a pilot that flies for non-scheduled airlines. And I've flown for about 20 of those over the past 25 years of my commercial flying career, which has extended over 32 years. I went to college and studied industrial design, but I didn't complete the full course. I went on to aviation as a career, and I was the youngest Boeing 707 captain to fly in commercial service when I was 28. I ran for the Nevada State Senate here in Nevada. Was unsuccessful in my bid, and as you know, my dad was William P. Lear Sr., who developed the Learjet executive aircraft, the 8-track stereo, and was the founder of Lear Incorporated, which is now Lear Sigler Corporation, a large defense contractor. I've done a lot of writing. I've written about airplanes and other subjects. I was a Middle East correspondent for Combat Illustrated between 1975 and 1977 when I was stationed in Beirut with TMA, Trans-Mediterranean Airlines. And, you know, my dad was really interested in UFOs and used to discuss it a lot to the great concern of the Pentagon because he was a defense contractor. But my interest didn't come around until, about 1985. A friend of mine who I had flown in Laos with came through Nellis Air Force Base. He was changing from the regular Air Force into the Air National Guard and called me up, came over, and we had a few beers and started talking about where we'd been since we'd seen each other. And I asked him where all he'd been stationed, and one of the places he mentioned was Bentwaters. Now, Bentwaters, as you know, is an Air Force base about 70 miles northeast of London, in which we have a few planes and tactical wings stationed at. And this was supposedly a place where a saucer had supposedly landed in 1980. And I had heard about the incident, so when Greg said, you know, Bentwaters, I said, oh, that's supposedly where that saucer landed in 1980. He said, no, John, not supposedly it did. He said, I didn't see it because I was confined in quarters, but I know the guys that did see it, and he gave me the names of General Gordon Williams and Major Ted Conrad and Colonel Chuck Hald. And I looked at Greg and said, you mean this stuff is real? There are saucers and aliens? He says, well, apparently so. So I thought I knew a lot about secret things and secret goings-on, but this one I had completely missed. So I spent the next 2 years kind of researching around, writing letters, taking field trips, trying to find out if there was such a thing as flying saucers and aliens. And my trips took me to Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, California. And this was towards the end of 1987. And when I got back, I wrote what became known as the infamous John Lear hypothesis, and released it to a couple of friends of mine, and they released it on a BBS, and it was apparently downhill from there on. But essentially, what I thought I found out was that the government had been dealing with extraterrestrials since 1964, and that apparently we did have an agreement with them in which we would trade, we would help them keep their secret of their existence in trade for high-level technology. And that was the basis of the hypothesis. I'm not sure whether, in fact, that is what is happening. One of the things I've tried to do is file everything but not believe anything. As you know, Robert Anton Wilson says you are a prisoner of your beliefs, and I've really found that to be true, that if you get stuck in any one single belief, you're imprisoned that. Everything seems to orient towards that belief. So I've tried to keep an open mind on this, whether in fact there are aliens. I don't know that for a fact. Whether in fact there are extraterrestrial vehicles, I don't know that for a fact. But some of the evidence points that way.
Well, we know for sure that UFOs are real. That's that can be proven by a short trip of about 140 miles north-northwest.
There's no question about that. The question is whether they're extraterrestrial or not.
That's correct. What kind of credence can you put into the sources of your information, John? I mean, who are these people?
Well, you have to realize that it's very difficult to establish whether somebody is telling the truth or whether he's a disinformation agent. In my particular case, since I am relatively high profile and have a famous name, I'm not sure whether that's a help or not, but I'm an easy target for disinformation. So to say that I have, you know, the best of sources would not be accurate. I might have the best of disinformation sources, but I do have a variety of sources. Some tell me there are, in fact, extraterrestrial vehicles up at the test site. Some tell me that there are not. So what I say is, you know, I try to file everything and believe nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, my listeners are certainly used to hearing that, because my admonition to them is to listen to everyone, read everything, believe nothing until they can verify it for themselves.
Well, I think that's very sound advice, and it's advice that I try to follow.
Well, in a period of time when there's so much disinformation and manipulation in an effort to tear down the sovereign status of nations and bring about a one-world government, it's difficult at best, even if you spend all of your time digging for the truth, to really know when you've reached it. And I think everybody had better begin to understand that. John, what are some of the more memorable moments in your dealings with this UFO business that you can remember? Some of the characters or some of the stories, or maybe we can inject a little bit of humor into this before we get a little more serious.
Well, I'm trying to think. I think one of the more memorable times was when I first got into this and had read a book called Communion, and it was very interesting. As a matter of fact, I read it on a flight that I flew from Las Vegas to Cleveland, and when I got to Cleveland, I couldn't put the book down, and after I did put it down, I couldn't go to sleep, and for some reason, I felt this was something real that was going on. And I'd heard of this guy, Bud Hopkins, and I was based in New York at the time, so I gave him a call, and he said, yeah, come on down. And I went down to his apartment in Manhattan, and we sat around for about 3 or 4 hours listening to some of the tapes that he recorded of people who had thought that they had been abducted. Now, you know, whether these were true or not, I don't know, but the people who were talking certainly felt it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these stories they that were so poignant, essentially horrifying of some of the things that happened to him. It just made a real impression of me when I was first got into this. It's the first time I heard of these kinds of stories, and sitting there with Bud was, I can't say it was memorable. It sure was, and it made an impression on me. Another of the times was I was acquainted with a scientist here in Las Vegas. His name was Bob Lazar, who claimed to work at the test site. And one night he took us out to see one of the alleged test flights of these vehicles. He said it was going to fly just after sunset. This was March 22nd, 1989. We went out there, parked our vehicle, and sure enough, about 15 minutes later, this orange glowing disc rises up from behind the mountains and performs a few maneuvers and then goes back down. I thought that was pretty spectacular. Bob said it was extraterrestrial. Since I have no way of knowing whether it was extraterrestrial or man-made, I can't really, you know, comment on what it was. It was just spectacular that this thing came up, made no noise, and flew around at tremendous speeds, and then went back down. That was a pretty memorable moment.
I can vouch for that, and it is memorable when you see it. I've been out there many times, and have actually spent weeks in the desert filming these things, and I've made two video documentaries of these craft actually in flight over the test site, and it is amazing to stand there and see them and know that this is a technology that's been completely hidden from the public, and it's in the possession of secret agencies of the United States government. And who cares whether it's extraterrestrial or man-made? I tend to think that it's man-made myself. But it represents a different science that could possibly benefit mankind greatly. And I think that it's a crime to keep this kind of a thing hidden. And they are disc-shaped, and they do things that are incredible. I don't know if you ever witnessed this, John, but I have literally seen them disappear from the sky. I mean, they're not there anymore. And then reappear sometimes seconds, sometimes minutes later, sometimes in the same spot, and sometimes several miles away. Have you ever witnessed that type of behavior?
No, I've never seen that myself, but I've talked to enough people who have seen those kinds of disappearances, and I hardly agree with you that we don't know whether that particular disc that I saw was man-made. There certainly are man-made ones that perform with equal speed and dexterity, and I have reason to believe that we were much further ahead in the late 50s, and the public was led to believe when Vanguard was blowing up every flight on the Canaveral pad. I think that we were very far advanced in our modes and method of travel. I have reason to believe that we were on the moon in the late 50s. And, you know, one of the interesting things that Dr. Wernher von Braun said at his retirement party in the late, or in the middle 70s, was he made a cryptic statement. He said, it's too bad Vanguard had to be the scapegoat. And I think what he was telling us was that he was part of a program that was so far advanced, but his name was associated with Vanguard, and all people remember is that thing kept blowing up on the pad, mm-hmm. going up 20 feet and exploding and toppling over, and I think that's what he was referring to.
Well, I think that was to keep the public's attention. It's well known amongst those who really do real research. Most researchers or people who call themselves researchers don't even know what the word means. But there are several references in several books and texts that are not well known to the public that disclosed the existence of a secret space program that even had a director of space and was administered mainly under the Navy, Department of the Navy, through DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And the public, of course, was told that that NASA was the only space program when in fact Eisenhower had established this secret space program by executive order in the early 50s. What have you learned about that, John?
Along the similar lines, as a matter of fact, to keep it secret, I think that between 1955 and 1958, it was illegal to mention the word space in any publications in the United States. They were so afraid that the public would find out how far along they were, and only with the advent of Vanguard and that were these horrible examples of our technology were being shown to the public, so that they would think that there was no possible way that we could have advanced like we did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I agree with you. There certainly was a secret program going on at that time.
Well, what brings the development of technology really home to me is my great-grandmother, who was no longer living, but I remember as a boy she would tell me stories of her trip across the United States from the East Coast in a covered wagon. And her first home in the West Texas prairie was a dugout with a sod roof. And she told me stories of the Indian Wars and all kinds of things. And she lived to see the development of the Boeing 707 and all the modern accoutrements of our society today. And I was always dumbstruck by this. I just could not imagine how people who went through that much of a transition in technology in their life could even keep their sanity, much less understand what was happening. Your father made a lot of references, and I understand that he was on a television show or something. Was it in the 60s, John?
In the late 50s, in a press conference, I think it was from Colombia. It was from South America, that flying saucers are real, and they were piloted by highly intelligent beings. Is this the one you're referring to?
Well, that's one, but the one I was more specifically referring to was the statement he made on television. Someone asked him, and I think it was on television, I'm not sure, John, correct me if I'm wrong, but someone asked him on television, since he was involved in the defense industrial establishment, just exactly where was the state of technology and what could we expect to see within the next 5 or 10 years. And the quote that I have is he said that you would be able to get into a phone booth in Los Angeles and step out in New York City.
Yeah, that's correct. I think that happened in the late 50s. It was a television or radio program. I can't remember what.
Well, a lot of people don't pay any attention to that, but I know that this man, your father, was on the inside of the inner circle of the people who were developing the state of the art of the technology of the world. And I think if he made that statement, he was talking about something that was either in the state of preliminary development or may have already been a reality. But, of course, those of us who served in the intelligence community, I was in the Office of Naval Intelligence, and you've been connected with the Central Intelligence Agency and the Joint Chiefs, we know that in secret they're at least 50 to 100 years ahead of anything that the public sees as the state of the art of any technology.
No question about it. No question about it.
And that's why when people tell me that we don't have a laser scalpel that could make surgical cuts like they find on these mutilated animals that's portable, I just laugh at them. I don't let them know that I'm laughing at them. They think I'm just laughing because it's funny. But I'm laughing because they really tend to believe that what they see is the state of the art in the public sector is really the state of the art of technology. And it's not at all. It's way behind.
Well, certainly if my dad wasn't, and of course neither one of us will probably ever know whether he was directly involved with that state of technology, he certainly had friends that were, specifically Hoyt Vandenberg, who was original director of the CIA, used to be around the house all the time, Jimmy Doolittle, who was definitely connected with the saucer program. He was sent over to Sweden to investigate the ghost rockets, and he had a very heavy involvement in the later years with the saucer program. People have asked me if my dad was involved in anti-gravity research. Of course, that was born in 1942, and we're talking about like 55, which would make me 13 or 14 years old. He certainly wouldn't have told me anything, so I wouldn't have no knowledge of that. Talking with my mother, he used to make trips to Fort Huachuca, and it seems that Fort Huachuca was the central area for some very classified technology research, possibly having to do with anti-gravity, but that's as far as I can trace it now. If I had become interested in this subject just a few years earlier, I would have been able to talk with the chief physicist at Lear Incorporated, who was a guy named Nils Eklund, Scandinavian, and a very competent guy.
Is he still alive, Joe?
No, unfortunately, like I say, he died just before I got into this research, or I would have been able to find out from him some really good information. But he passed away, I believe, in 1982 or 83.
Well, I know that you've had some contact with some of the more famous or infamous, depends upon which way you look at it, people in the so-called UFO community, which I think is a misnomer. And a lot of these people who call themselves ufologists, which in every case is self-appointed and requires no requirements, no education. That's right. Right. What can you tell me about some of these people? What can you tell our listeners?
Well, it just seems that there's so many self-appointed researchers who spew forth so much BS about so much stuff that, you know, I've tried to kind of gotten out of the field myself to the extent that I may give one or two lectures a year, that I no longer, as I did at one time, believe the public should be told, because I don't think they would understand the religious ramifications of what's going on is might confuse them as to what is really going on, and I don't think they can sort this out or need to sort it out on a daily basis.
Well, that's assuming that extraterrestrials are a reality, which they may not be.
Definitely may not be.
Yeah.
Who knows for real who these are? I've heard many stories.
Well, I used to think that they were real. As you well know, I saw documents when I was in the Office of Naval Intelligence that said they were real.
And it's possible that they are, but there's also stories of people who have been abducted who have caught their supposed aliens taking off masks or helmets,
and turning into military personnel. Yes, I've also run into those people also. And I've looked into the possibility that this whole thing is a tremendous mind control operation. In order to convince the public of the world, the mass consciousness of humanity, that the Earth is being threatened by some other species from some other planet, which Ronald Reagan stated in six of his speeches during his administration, which is way too many times for me to believe that that it was real. It's more like it's putting it into people's minds. I've looked into the development of mind control techniques, and they are so far advanced that mind control is no longer experimental. It's fully operational. And from what I understand, from my contacts, and from what I've been able to read and the leaks and the documents released under the Freedom of Information Act, that no part of mind control remains experimental anymore, and that they can literally remove sections of memory as if it never occurred and put in its place a different memory, as if they're running a movie in your head, and they can actually put in suggestions or orders to that this will not come up, you will not remember this until some outside stimulus is encountered, and then the mind is overwhelmed by these incredible memories that in actual fact never happened. In particular, I remember reading and studying mind control projects by the Office of Naval Intelligence, where they were actually putting together and ran an assassination bureau for many years, and these people who were actually the assassins were ordinary people that they would pick according to some standard formula, put them through the brainwashing experience where they would implant in their mind the ability and the desire to kill upon order. And they would go about their normal everyday business not even knowing that they were part of this until the stimulus was given to them and they were given an order to carry out an assassination, and they would go and do this. What do you know about all this, John? Are you there?
Yeah.
What can you tell us about these mind control programs?
Well, you're 100% correct. It works just like that. I was reading a book called Operation Mind Control just the other day, in which a guy asked for people, military people, who felt that they had been subject to mind control experiments. And there was a Air Force officer who felt that he was having some problems in later life after he retired, and it evolved from the fact that his whole career, or at least the 5 years that he thought he was stationed in Guam running a weather station, when he retired, he was honorably discharged, and he was shown a whole raft of commendations and medals that he had earned. And there was no explanation for that, and he said, can I have those? And they said, no, these will be withheld until you need them, and at that time, you know, it will be explained to whoever needs to see these what exactly happened. So this guy obviously did a lot more than he was aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Up at the Nevada test site, certainly this mind control works to a great degree, whereas people can remember flying up, flying back, but they can't remember what they did. The mind control is so advanced that it doesn't, they have it to the point where it doesn't bother people when they come back, say, to Las Vegas and they interact with their children and their wives and lead a normal daily life. They don't question that they can't remember what they did. It's highly, highly advanced. We were working with a female engineer who worked with Lockheed, who was having just a little bit of problem because she couldn't remember a lot of what she did during the day. And I think that they were not too successful in the mind control program there because she did realize that there were same things going on. But it is highly, highly evolved. People would be just shocked to know how far advanced it has become.
Well, it's time for a break, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back right after this very short pause. When I first started my crusade, I guess that's what you can call it, to try to wake people up, I had a tremendous faith in the American people that all that had to happen was for someone to open their eyes and show them that the normal everyday world that they live in is really a fantasy land, and then they would sort of take it from there, and it's not happening. A lot of people are wakening up. I have to give those people credit because back in 1988, 1987, when I first was looking around, in 1988, when I first came public with what I knew, sometimes I would travel 1,000 miles to sit in a living room and talk to three people if I could find three people that wanted to sit in the living room and listen to what I had to say. And now, when I go to a city, sometimes I can fill places as large as the Salt Dome with people who are interested in wanting to know what's happening. But when you consider how many people are there and how many people in the city aren't interested and don't want to know, then it doesn't look like such a big accomplishment. Do you think we're going to wake up this country? Do you think we're going to affect any kind of a change at all?
I don't think so, Bill, but, you know, I applaud the people who go out there and try. I don't try anymore because I found that people are satisfied with the information that they receive reading the paper in the morning, listening to Dan Rather on the news at 5 o'clock, and then watching Wheel of Fortune at 7:30. And most people are satisfied that they get about all they need know from that kind of information. It's discouraging because there's some great, great human beings that would like to make a change, but I just have to say that I am not an optimist at this point.
Well, I'm slowly getting to that not an optimist point also, but I have to keep trying. Every time I look at my little daughter, I can't stop trying to make this a better world because I know that if I fail, she's going to be somebody's property. And that's what's coming. I'm convinced of it. Everything, all the research that I've done shows me that instead of going forward in our evolutionary path, we're at a point where we've reached the highest pinnacle of all man's striving throughout history, where with the establishment of this nation, man actually became a sovereign king in his own right. Able to walk in a divine state of grace on this earth that God gave us. And no time in history had that ever been true before. And it still isn't true today in any other nation on this earth except this country, the United States of America. And what I see in the future is a step backward, back into slavery, in a totalitarian socialist world government. And all of these things that are happening around us, I see leading us right into that, including the election of Mr. Rhodes Scholar Clinton here.
Yeah.
Is just a continuation along that path.
Correct in that, and I wish there was something we could do, but I'm not sure what it is. I certainly applaud your efforts to continue on and try and do something, but I've more or less given up myself. If you could show me the path of how we could affect the numbers of people we would have to do in the short time we have to make a difference, I would certainly rally behind you.
Well, time is short. It's so short, but people call me and they write me letters, and they one woman wrote me a letter, and it was about 6 pages long, and it was all about her being upset with me because I had said that most Americans are stupid over the radio, and I use that term quite often because I found that most Americans are stupid, and the definition of that word is mentally crippled. In many cases, it's not their fault that they're stupid, but nevertheless, they are. And she was so upset with that word that I knew that I had reached her and had made her angry enough that maybe she would begin to look at it, even though she was voicing great displeasure about it. You see, it's my theory that if I say Americans are stupid over the radio, only the stupid Americans will get angry when they hear it.
I would prefer to say that they're ignorant.
Well, it goes far beyond ignorant, John. Ignorant is when you don't know about something. You've never had an opportunity to learn. Nobody taught you.
You don't have the information.
That's right. Stupid is where you have the information and you don't know how to put it together. You don't know how to think originally. You believe what you're told all the time without question. And that's where most Americans are. They don't question anything. Nothing at all. And that is really bothersome to me.
They believe they have a democracy. Most of them don't even know the difference between a democracy or a republic.
That's correct, and they don't understand that the increased use of the word democracy is leading us into socialism, because democracy is just another word for socialism.
Right.
It's where everybody has a vote, and the majority get their way, and they always vote themselves all the benefits until there's nothing left, and a dictator rises up to take over. And clear everything out, and that's always where socialism leads, and that's where we're going right now. John, what are you engaged in now? What kind of projects are you doing now?
Really, no projects. I apply at 727 for a cargo airline. We have a contract out of Miami. We run fertilized chickens to Valencia. Other than that, I'm working on my garden as usual. You know, when you're here, I like to have the greenest lawn on my block, and I like to do all kinds of gardening projects. Other than that, I'm quite heavily involved in computers. I got involved in computers a couple of years ago, and I have a PC, and it's mostly to write. And also, my wife has a actor and actress casting business. We cast extras here in Las Vegas for the movies that come from Hollywood, so I computerized her business, and I mess around with that, but that's about the extent of my extracurricular activity.
Well, what do you foresee for the immediate future? You got any predictions for us?
No. As a matter of fact, I'd have to agree with a German interviewer who came over here and said that I was a great researcher, but a horrible prophet. Several times I said, absolutely, within a year, some information is going to come out. And then I said, in 1991, some information was going to come out. And it just never seemed to happen. So,
well, some information is always coming out.
Information is always coming out. But I meant something like,
something big,
gigantic revelation. And I've always been wrong, so I've quit making any kind of predictions. I just sit back and watch with great interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think anything like that's going to happen until they're ready to actually put the chains on our legs, and then they'll cause so many things to happen and so many revelations to come out, and most of it will be deception and lies, that everybody will be so confused they'll be totally deactivated. They won't even be able to think, much less act. That's what I think is going
to
happen.
Well, I just want enough time to call all my friends and say, I told you so. And also, when they round us up, Bill, I want to be one of the first ones to go because I want a lower bunk and I want to get the blanket concession.
Well, I understand they've already got my name on the door. So, that is if they let me get that far. John, I'm going to slip one in on you here. Who is Lars Hansen?
Lars was a supposed researcher who came and lived at my house as a carpenter. Did a lot of projects around my house in about 1988. Spent three or four months here and left. I think he lives in Florida now. He was greatly interested in the Kennedy assassination. He had made a tape which purported to show that William Greer, the driver, turned around and shot Kennedy. We showed that tape quite a few times. I went back and actually paid Robert Groden $200 to see the original of that tape, which then I since found out was not an original. It was a copy of the Time Life film. So I went back and actually paid Robert Groden $200 to see the original of that tape, which then I since found out was not an original. It was a copy of the Time Life film. I went back and actually paid Robert Groden $200 to see the original of that tape, which then I since found out was not an original. It was a copy of the Time Life film. And it didn't make it any clearer. Anyway, Lars promoted that tape, and then maybe the end of 1989 changed his mind that he didn't feel that Greer did shoot Kennedy, and retracted all his statements, and I think he lives in Florida now. Back to Lars, I have a great deal of respect for people who change their minds based on new input and are willing to admit that they made a mistake. I can't remember how many times I've done that. What I disagree with is people who change their minds and say that they never believed that in the first place. In Lars' case, he says he never did believe that the Greer shot Kennedy, but for those people who really said one thing, like a particular aspect of aliens were real and flying saucers were real, and who have come to believe that maybe that's not the case, or have the guts and the moral fortitude to get up and say, yeah, I was wrong. Here's what I believe now. I think that takes a great deal of courage.
Well, that's I don't know how much courage it takes, but that's certainly what I've done. I think that that I was intentionally shown documents when I was in the Office of Naval Intelligence that convinced me that extraterrestrials were real. And I really believed that. And when I first came public, I told everybody what I saw in those documents. And I told them I didn't really know the reality of it, but that's what the documents said. And I had no reason to question those documents. But, John, when I first really began doing real research and quit believing what I saw and what people told me and really started digging into it, the first thing that I found when I did a computer search of documents in a library for anything about extraterrestrials or other species from other planets or anything like that, it popped out a document from 1917, which was the text of a speech given by John Dewey to the Japanese imperial delegation headed by Viscount Ishii in New York City. And the first thing out of his mouth, the first sentence in the speech was, and I printed this in the appendix of my book, was, quote, "Someone once told me that the best way to unite all humanity in a one-world government and do away with wars forever is if we were attacked by some other species from some other planet," unquote. And that was like somebody hit me between the eyes with a sledgehammer. And I felt that all through my body. I was just shaken to the core. And here I was looking at the evidence that somebody had thought of doing this as far back as 1917. And I knew instantly that they had the technology to make us all believe it if they wanted to. And then I began going back and looking at, when did all this start? Why, John, it started the minute that President Truman signed the United Nations Treaty and the Senate passed and Truman signed the UN Participation Act. And the first man who reported flying saucers was an ex-intelligence officer flying in a plane up in Washington who saw, or says he saw, nine disc-shaped craft come out of Canada and then go back in the same direction. And he described them as inverted saucers. And, of course, the press picked this up and called it flying saucers. Now, if you go back, like I did, and research the newspaper headlines of the day, they were all talking about the United Nations being the salvation of mankind and that all man would come together in one world government and there would be no more wars. And then you see Hollywood begin to crank out all the flying saucer movies. And what's the most famous one? No, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, The Day the Earth Stood Still, sure.
The classic of classics, and it's about a man from another world who comes here with a message of peace, and he's surrounded by guns, and he's shot, and the message was simply that we have to have a one-world government and do away with guns and arms and national boundaries, and that's been the message ever since. Have you ever attended a Stanton Friedman lecture?
No, I haven't.
I'll have to send you a tape. In his lectures now, he includes a portion about how the world has to come together and unite as one, and that we have to get rid of all weapons, and that the world should be ruled by a council of wise men. It's the same old utopian story that the Illuminati's been preaching throughout the history of the world, and it's impossible to bring about because man himself is flawed. What do you think about all this?
I think you're correct. I just disagree with the one world government. I just am not going for it myself.
Well, it can't be good because we're being manipulated into it instead of being allowed to be a participant in what it's going to be or how it's going to come about. We're being herded like a flock of sheep or cattle. Which reminds me, I've stopped calling people anymore. They're sheeple in my vocabulary, at least the ones who aren't awake yet. The ones who are awake are heroes in my eyes. I laud them. I appreciate them. All my efforts are in their directions, and hopefully if we all work together, we can wake up more of the sheeple and turn them into real people, I hope. John, if there were something that you would, well, let me put it another way. Inside each and every one of us, there's something that we want to do more than anything else in the world. What is that for you?
Bill, before I die, I want to be able to go to Carl's Jr. and drive up there and order a Carl's original hamburger and not have them ask me if I want a piece of cheese on it.
Not bad. Not bad. What do you think about the cattle mutilations, John?
Well, as you know, Linda Howe, who did the wrote Alien Harvest for the CBS affiliate in Denver, and I did a few field trips together and was able to talk to her quite a bit about it and thought I knew a lot about it. It's been going on for quite some time. It's obviously possible that we have the technology to do that. I suspect everything and everybody. Who is really doing it, I don't know. Why they're doing it, I don't know. I kind of suspect that AIDS comes into the question somewhere. But the more I find out, that the less I know.
And that's exactly what has happened to me.
For every question that I have answered, that I have found the answer to, there's been 20 more questions posed.
Yeah.
So now I'm almost hesitant to have a question answered because it just raises 20 more questions.
Well, you know, Arizona is one of the greatest experimental grounds for helicopter development in the country. Were you aware of that?
No.
They actually build Apache helicopters down in southern Arizona. And there's many times in Arizona you see flights of helicopters, all different types of helicopters. Recently there's been an awful lot of black unmarked helicopters with dark windows. You can't even see in the things. But they're apparently able to change the density of the windows from light to dark at will, because you can see the same helicopter. As it flies, the windows will either become opaque or clear. I don't know how they do that, but I guess it could be done with some pigment that changes color with the stimulus of electricity or heat. I don't know. But coming back from visiting my parents in Texas, we were driving up Route 666 near the Roosevelt Reservoir, and my wife and I both witnessed two helicopters flying. Couldn't have been more than 70 or 80 feet above the ground, and they were bobbing up and down according to the terrain. In other words, they obviously had terrain following radar, and they had the helicopter on automatic pilot, so it was following the exact contour of the terrain. And it was amazing to watch this, and they passed no more than 100 feet in front of the car across the highway, and they made not one sound, no noise whatsoever. Now, I'd heard rumors that there were helicopters that made no noise, and this was the first time that I had ever seen helicopters that made no noise. But these were helicopters. They were military helicopters, and they made no noise whatsoever. So I know that the rumors are true, that we do have helicopters that make no noise, and at night could configure themselves to look like UFOs and fly around fields and could pick up cattle without leaving footprints or signs or tracks, and could mutilate those cattle and drop them back in fields. Now, it's funny that not too long after these 10 or 15,000 cases of animal mutilation, mostly cattle, had been reported, we began to see stories in newspapers about cow's blood being used in emergencies for transfusions for humans. And we began to read all these experiments that they've been doing with cow's blood, but yet we can find no research facility by the government or anybody else with enough cattle to have performed any of these experiments to come up with the conclusions that they have reached. So I don't know the answer, and I'm not saying that that's the answer, and I'm not saying that it's the government doing it, but I'm very hesitant to believe that it's extraterrestrial simply because no one's ever been caught, mainly because of the nature of the organs and the tissue that is taken. All of it points to somebody wanting large amounts of blood and, number two, tissue samples that would tell what kind of pollution has moved up the food chain into large animals, specifically radiation. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a definite possibility. And there's no question in my mind that that they have these silent helicopters. I don't think, as some people say, that they're just very quiet. I think they are absolutely silent.
Well, the ones that passed about 100 feet in front of our car across the highway, in a very rural portion of Arizona where there's hardly any people at all except Indians who probably don't even care at all. Most rural people don't care if they see helicopters. But these things made no noise, John. No noise at all.
I had an interesting thing happen in April. I ferried an L-1011 from Marana, Texas to England. And they had occasion to stay at Marana, which, as you know, was an ex-Air Force base and then supposedly an ex-CIA base, and I had never been there before. But I was there for two or three nights, and every night about like 12 or 1 o'clock, there would be the most massive deployment of helicopters. It was just like being in Vietnam, and I spent several years over there. And I get up in the morning and where in the hell did those things come from? And the second night I finally asked somebody and they said, oh, they've got an underground facility that they use. It comes out of the middle of the runway. And he was very nonspecific, but apparently there is quite a large underground base under Marana, and that's the first I'd heard about it, but I never believed it until I stayed down there. There must be something underground because there was nowhere else for these things to park. And I was quite familiar with the field, having flown in and flown out.
Well, it's we have those things here also. While I was out filming my last documentary at the test site north of you there, filming these craft in flight, we spent one day, usually we were out there all night and slept all day, but we spent one day, and some of our party climbed up to the top of the mountain, and while we were filming, a helicopter came out from about the area where the road disappears and goes into the Groom Lake area, the Groom Dry Lake area. It came out and flew around the valley, and we didn't know what it was doing, but a part of the mountain on the side of the Tickaboo Valley, as you're looking from that little turnout there where we filmed toward the Groom Lake facility, part of the mountain just opened up and this helicopter flew right into the mountain and the door closed and it didn't even look like a door. I mean, it was desert land.
I was on the same mountain and I saw the helicopter fly into what appeared to be a mountain, but I didn't see a door open, but it definitely disappeared.
Yeah.
And I could show you on a map exactly where I saw that happen.
It's probably the exact same spot. With the people up on the mountain, they all thought it just disappeared. They didn't see the door open either. And if I hadn't have been looking directly at that spot, I don't think I would have seen the door open either. But I managed to see the door open, and this helicopter flew in, and it just closed back behind it. And it was incredible to watch this. It was like watching an old Flash Gordon movie. I don't know if you ever saw those old Flash Gordon serials, but they had a part where this spaceship is flying along and it goes into this mountain and all these cowboys are chasing it on the horseback, and they just go up to the cliff and there's a cliff and they don't know what happened. I remember that from when I was a kid. And the reason I remember it is because all of these things about underground bases and flying saucers brought that memory back to me. John, I think that people had better start paying attention to this and had better begin to do something, at least think. I mean, thinking is a starting point, I believe. But we're out of time. Maybe we can do this another night, do this again, because there's a lot of things that maybe we should have talked about that we didn't get to. Would you consent to come back on another night?
It sure was enjoyable. I can't believe the time has passed this quickly. But, yeah, I think there's a lot of other things that we could delve into. I sure wish I shared your optimism, or I don't know whether it's optimism or realistic thinking. But certainly people have got to wake up, and there's no question about that.
Well, I think that our forefathers had the right idea, but I also think that they did this as an experiment. And I think that through reading their writings, it's clear to me that they were well-versed in human nature. And they knew all the way back then that we would probably lose our republic through our own abdication, ignorance, stupidity, whatever you want to call it. But I think the experiment's not over yet, because it's not gone yet, and I think we can take it back. If people just could be brought to understand what it is that they're going to lose, then maybe they would be willing to do something about it. But all throughout history, I see that even our own revolution was only carried out by less than 5% of the people who lived in the colonies. The rest were either solidly on the side of King George or, frankly, my dear, just didn't give a damn. So we'll just have to see. I don't know what my frame of mind is, except that I just absolutely refuse to give up. And every time I get down or think about it, I just have to look at it. I just look at my daughter. And that's the end of that thought. I mean, I'm back on track again and clear sailing. John, thank you so much for being our guest tonight.
And thank you to our listening audience. Good night, and God bless you all.